The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, Governor Brian Kemp has his proposed budget for the state, and the agencies, well, they have their needs as well. So we will hear what lawmakers were told this week. It's a big old recap of what happened under the Gold Dome. Also, $65 million. It's a lot of money. It's the largest donation in the history of the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation. And later, from the special grand jury report regarding Georgia's 2020 presidential election to finding out who, how, when, why, and where the Roe versus Wade draft was leaked last year. Well, we'll get to all of this as we speak with former U.S. Attorney Michael Moore, who will provide some legal insight. Those conversations coming up, but we'll begin with this. Activists and social justice groups say they will demonstrate this weekend in Atlanta. Now, that's after authorities say a shootout on Wednesday killed a protester and injured a state trooper on the site for the planned fire and police training facility for those workers here in Atlanta. As Shemaine Cruz reports, seven people are now facing domestic terrorism charges.
Advocates with the Atlanta Solidarity Fund say they're also planning to file a wrongful death lawsuit as questions remain about what led up to the shooting. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation has identified the person who was shot and killed as 26-year-old Manuel Esteban Paez Terran. Authorities say seven people, all from out of state, were arrested and are now facing domestic terrorism and illegal trespass charges. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Now, as for those charged with domestic terrorism and trespassing, according to the GBI, in addition to the 25 illegal campsites that were cleared, they also confiscated, quote, mortar-style fireworks, multiple-edge weapons, pellet rifles, gas masks, and a blowtorch, close quote. Protesters and the supporters were calling for the release of body camera footage of the shooting, but the GBI tells WABE there is no such body camera footage of the shooting. Police and protesters have clashed for more than a year at this proposed training site, which is actually located in DeKalb County. Now, those arrested were all from out of state, and they range in age from 20 to 35. There was no release information about the weapon that shot the officer. In other news, just back from his European trip, Governor Brian Kemp's office is again touting his efforts to improve the state's economy, saying they've created nearly 118,000 jobs and billions in investments. As Alex Helmick reports, it's a narrative the governor has used since retaking office.
Early into the pandemic in 2020, Georgia became one of the first states to relax lockdown rules. As Kemp said, to help hurting businesses, it became a point he used in his reelection. And the state, in the last couple of years, has doled out billions in tax breaks to lure companies here, especially in the electric vehicle sector. Earlier this week, Kemp took his message to the world's richest and most powerful at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, where he called Georgia a model on how to conduct business in the current economy. Alex Helmick, WAB News.
Atlanta Public School Superintendent Dr. Lisa Herring says her priority is to ensure all students who are in pre-K will graduate high school ready for college or the workforce. Martha Dalton has more from Thursday's State of the District address.
Herring said there's meaning behind the event's theme, Mission Possible APS 2036. That's the year current pre-kindergarten students will be seniors in high school, and Herring's mission is to ensure that they all graduate ready for college or careers.
Our students have to know before they leave us, and quite honestly, before they hit high school, they have to have a sense of career relevance and interest and talents so that they feel engaged, so that we keep them at a space where they're pursuing a talent and a dream, or perhaps an unidentified one.
To do that, Herring said, the district needs help from philanthropic partners and community volunteers who are willing to serve as mentors. The district's high school graduation rate has ticked up the past few years in spite of the pandemic. It reached a high of 84% last year. Martha Dalton, WABE News.
And a note of disclosure, WABE's broadcast license is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. Georgians can now weigh in on a proposal to mine for titanium and other minerals near the Okefenokee Swamp, as we hear from Emily Jones.
The controversial proposal to mine near the swamp has drawn opposition for years from environmentalists and scientists. Rhett Jackson is a hydrologist at the University of Georgia. He's concerned about mining on a key geological feature known as Trail Ridge. He says the mine could increase the frequency and severity of droughts in the swamp.
If they're taking that water out of Trail Ridge, it's not going to the swamp. So that water is lost at the times when the swamp really needs it.
Jackson says more droughts could hurt the ecosystem, increase wildfires, and make it harder for boaters to visit the popular swamp. The president of the mining company, which is called Twin Pines, says the claims that his project would harm the swamp are absurd. Now, the State Environmental Protection Division has published a draft of the land use plan for the mine, and regulators are accepting public comment for 60 days. State Representative Darlene Taylor tried to ban mining on Trail Ridge last year, though her bill failed to pass. She says she expects many people to weigh in.
This is a very unique opportunity for the state of Georgia and our people to save that property. It doesn't need to be mined.
Taylor says she plans to introduce another bill to block future mining on Trail Ridge. Emily Jones, WABE News.
And coming up next, what happened under the Gold Dome this week? And you can count how many times I say Gold Dome. We'll check in with our WABE politics reporters. This is Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Sure, it's a cliche, but it's never a dull moment under the Gold Dome. Raul Bali will appreciate that. State lawmakers are now finished with their first full week since the session got underway. Let's get the word on the legislative curb. Daniel Rizel will appreciate that with our WAB political reporters, Raul Bali and Sam Greenglass. Welcome.
I think I've had maybe dull moments, but I hear you.
You've had some dull moments?
Some of those meetings, you know.
Now. All right.
I do my best not to let anything be dull.
Yes, we've noticed, Raul. We appreciate you. Sam, let's start with you because there's some news on what could be next for this special grand jury's investigation. What are you hearing?
So what happens next Tuesday? There's going to be this big hearing in Fulton County Court. Judge Robert McBurney is going to weigh basically whether this report of the special grand jury, which has now been dissolved, whether it should be released and also when. And who's going to appear? It's probably going to be prosecutors and mostly lawyers for the media who are going to be arguing that this report should be released quickly and as fully as possible. Today, we just popped off a conference call with Norm Eisen, a legal scholar who's really closely studied this Fulton County investigation. And his takeaway is that it is not a question of if this report is going to be released, but when. And the key thing that we're likely to hear from prosecutors is it's in their interest to have this report not released until they're coming out with indictments, if they do, to tie those things together. So they might be pushing to, hey, can you hold off on this until we're ready to bring charges for a grand jury?
Is there a collective, and either one of you can answer this, of media folks, we folks, that are pushing to make this public, or at least so the media have access to it, the press club, any other, you know, media-related, credible media-related associations here?
I mean, I think one group we expect to be at the front of this is the AJC, who has lawyers who will likely be pushing for this to be released. WAB is not involved in that, to my knowledge.
All right. Now over to you, Raul. You were just outside of the Capitol covering a rally held by Georgia Right to Life.
That's right. It's one of those events that is held every year. So this Sunday marks the 40th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And on or around the anniversary, both sides generally hold events here at the state capitol. As you mentioned, Georgia Right to Life and their supporters are across the street at the state capitol over in Liberty Plaza. They're going to march here in just probably a few minutes if they haven't already started marching around the Capitol. My big takeaway is that while they're happy that Roe was overturned and that Georgia's six-week abortion ban is on the books, they do want further restrictions. Specifically, right now, Georgia's current law bans abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. They want a complete ban. And the other thing that I heard across the street was possibly putting something in the Georgia Constitution. I should mention that abortion rights supporters will also have events, including one here at the state capitol Sunday at 1 o'clock.
And Ro, just for clarity, unless I didn't hear you correctly, you said 40th, but I think it's the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, correct?
You had to ask me a math. No, you're right. Wait, I'm trying
put
to
the
think.
Math skills to work there,
yes.
Raul.
Yeah, you know what? Georgia State's proud of Raul and his economics degree.
Why are you going to put it on Georgia State?
I'm putting on Georgia State, yes. No, yeah, you're correct. It would be the 50th anniversary.
I'm sure it's making Georgia State professors feel just proud.
I just don't want to realize how close I am to my 50th birthday. That's actually what's going on.
I had nothing to do with that. I want to go back, though, let's get back to the lawmakers as well. Let's turn to House Speaker John Burns, who held a press conference yesterday, sort of outlining some legislative priorities, including abortion. I want our listeners to take a listen to this.
I think the posture that the House should be in is certainly the posture that John Burns is in. We're going to wait and see exactly what becomes with the legislation we passed. We're going to make sure that legislation with House Bill 481, the language in it is effective and is supported, and certainly we believe it is, that it was good legislation, it's good policy, but we're certainly waiting to make sure the process works. We're going to hear from state Supreme Court, and then we'll move forward on something then if we need to. If not, we certainly have something in place.
Now, which one of you would like to break that down, and D. John Burns leads that for us?
So let me, the question that was asked was, do you see anything moving in terms of legislation on abortion this session? And specifically, the legislation that died last session dealing with chemical abortion, those using pills. So as you heard the speaker say, he's going to take a wait and see approach. The Georgia six-week abortion ban is going to be heard, a challenge to it. It's going to be heard in the Georgia Supreme Court on March the 28th. That's the day before the last day of the session.
Yeah.
So I think if you're waiting to hear, that's going to be, you know, let's see what the Supreme Court does. That kind of tells you you're not going to see much movement here. There's not an appetite for that movement to do something here at the state capitol.
Though he was asked separately about abortion pills and that bill that died last session, which would require an in-person office visit and stop mailing of abortion pills, he did say he thought that was a good bill and he would wait to see if it pops up. So that is something that could come up separate from, you know, a broader round of abortion legislation, as Burns is saying, about waiting till after the Supreme Court rules.
And another issue that has come up, which is related to quality of life for Georgians, is about housing. What did he say in terms of his priorities toward any legislative that deals with that?
So, you know, and this is probably something we heard a lot yesterday, is I'm going to wait to see what kind of legislation comes up, what comes our way. But on housing, the interesting thing that I took away in that conversation, that was actually the question that I asked the speaker during the press conference, mm-hmm. is he doesn't want to get involved in the decisions on zoning and code enforcement made by local governments. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm watching for when it comes to corporations buying homes or building neighborhoods, or, you know, what happens with housing affordability, because there is an absolute realization in the Capitol that if you know, you know the idea of, you know, and you heard that in Alex Helmut's story in your newscast, in your news brief, is Georgia's economic development, you know, could be challenged by having enough workers, whether mm-hmm. they're, you know, produced here in Georgia or brought in here into Georgia, and where to house them. Those are two challenges. And so you've got lawmakers and the governor looking at how do you deal with this?
Mm-hmm. Sam, what about you? Any priorities or measures that you are also hoping to see or waiting to see and hear what the speaker has to say?
Well, I think one thing that Raul and I both noticed from sitting in this press conference this week is that answer that you mentioned, we'll wait and see, that's interesting, there's discussions. We heard that for almost every policy issue that was brought up, not a whole lot of specific pronouncements or drawing a line in the sand about where he felt about issues. So at least it seems to me in this first term of his speakership, I'm expecting that a lot will be directed from, you know, the governor's office in terms of the budget priorities and things of that nature. You know, Burns was kind of, you know, whether it's that he's holding his cards close to his chest or he's letting, you know, the governor's office determine the priorities in these next few months, that was certainly the takeaway that I had this session.
Well, as lawmakers are starting to hold these budget hearings this week and with agency heads, you know, look from transportation, education, and many more making their case, any ones that stuck out to you all this week in terms of what they're asking for? And I know with DFACS, that's a whole nother hour, but there's so many of these departments that are really making a plea to lawmakers saying this is what we need. And it's not always just money, but it's a big part of it.
I mean, it's interesting because in some ways, these budget talks are kind of the most unvarnished view that we get to look into government agencies and what they need and what their challenges are in this moment. It kind of allows you to peel back the curtain of these broad, like, we're doing so great, we have all this surplus, you know, rah-rah about the days ahead. And you see these little glimmers that kind of help illuminate some of the challenges that different parts of our government are facing. And two that stuck out to me, one, in the presentation of the Director of Public Health, Dr. Kathleen Toomey, mm-hmm. She mentioned that over the pandemic, maternal mortality actually got worse in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And as we've know very well, it is already really, really bad in Georgia, among mm-hmm. the worst in the nation. So that was one thing that popped out to me. And the other is in the presentation from Sonny Perdue, Chancellor of the University of Georgia system, that enrollment overall across the system is declining, and it's declined over the last couple of years. And he called it a demographic cliff that the system is facing yeah. that might end up leading to budget cuts. So two moments that kind of help us understand the underside to some of this happy economic news that we're hearing in other places.
Yeah, the university system, that was alarming. Raul, what about you? What, in terms of these agencies and their budget requests, what stood out to you?
I'm always interested in the questions that lawmakers ask. And it wasn't a budget head, but it was the governor's state economist. Mm-hmm. And when he wrapped up, there were so, and we already just talked about it, so many questions about housing and, mm-hmm. and what to do about housing. I don't remember this many questions up here, you know, and I think I mentioned to you on a previous show, you know, you keep hearing about housing and what to do about it. It's like other issues. People know that that something needs to be done, but then the next question, you know, what to do about it. And then the other thing, when Richard Woods, the state school superintendent, was up on the dais, he mm-hmm. was asked about the QBE, which is the basic funding mm-hmm. formula for state money for schools. And he was asked, hey, is it time to overhaul it? Well, again, you hear this all the time. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's time to overhaul it. The one thing he did say is, he would hope for a piecemeal approach, a little at a time, to see the effects of those changes. Look, the discussion is, you know, is it time to change the state formula that is 40 years old on education and how it's funded? You hear the answer is generally yes. What to replace it with? You don't hear that answer as often.
And Raul, I have to ask you this. Buckhead Cityhood, I mean, is it still on the minds of some lawmakers? What are you hearing?
It's not a big discussion up here, at least not yet. I think it's just one of those things where once the bill drops, maybe the conversations get going. It mainly is people asking me, hey, have you heard anything yet? I just haven't yet. You know, it's if the bill gets dropped, then we'll see where it starts going.
All right. And before we go, listen, we're still very early in this session, but you all, I hear there are a lot of bills that are in the works. You want to take a stab at how many?
So far, we only have 71 bills and resolutions filed. If you go down, so I'm sitting in the House chamber, about 100 feet from me is the Office of Legislative Counsel. They're the ones who draft all the bills. You know how many bills they've already drafted? 979. That means there's 900 bills waiting out here to be filed. So
imagine all the bills about animals and food trucks and all these things that we'll have to tease through over the next 2 months.
And raw milk. Is the raw milk making a comeback here, Raul? Because it's a big deal. I mean, we have fun with it, but it's a big deal. And I get it on both sides. It's a big deal.
Well, I thought raw milk did get done. But I have heard at least one person say, is there a raccoon bill in the works? So I will keep you updated on any raccoon bills.
What?
I don't know. Somebody inferred it in one of the budget meetings. Will there be? I'm like, okay, maybe. I don't know.
Leave our little raccoons alone. I mean, okay. All right. I tell you.
I'm just here to cause trouble, Rose.
All right. Yeah, you are, and you do a very good job of that. Raul Bali, Sam Greenglass, WABE's political reporters. As always, I appreciate you taking the time. Send all your raccoon-related hate email to Raul, not me.
CC me. Just CC.
CC.
Thanks, Rose.
Thanks, Rose.
Take care, fellas. You're tuned to Closer Look from WABE. I'm Rose Scott. The Center for Constitutional Rights referred to Ashley Diamond's 2015 landmark lawsuit as, quote, challenging the cruel and unusual treatment of incarcerated trans people by the Georgia Department of Corrections, close quote. And Ashley Diamond actually sued twice, first for denying her access to hormone therapy, as well as once for prison officials refusing to protect her from repeated sexual assault and other forms of neglect. Now, the first case was resolved in 2016, and it led to dozens of incarcerated trans people in Georgia with the ability to receive hormones. And she filed the second lawsuit in November of 2020. And Ashley Diamond was released from prison in August of last year. Yesterday, as the other case was set to begin, Diamond announced through the Southern Poverty Law Center she was dropping the lawsuit to focus on healing. But perhaps leading up to all of this, might Diamond's lawsuits bring about nationwide change with correctional facilities? We're going to talk about this case and some other big legal-related news from this week. Join me now, Attorney Michael J. Moore, former U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia, the same court where Diamond's second trial would have taken place. And a note, he is not involved in any of the cases we're about to discuss. Attorney Moore, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you again. Thanks, Rose.
Lots to get to. Of course, you're not representing Ashley Diamond, but as a former U.S. attorney, what are your thoughts in terms of, and Ms. Diamond has obviously the right to do this, but the change of heart here, in a sense, opting not to go through with the second lawsuit here?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm glad to be with you. I am not representing Ms. Diamond or have anything to do with the case. I do know that some of the individuals in the case, and it's a good court to be in. I think the judge was is a very well respected judge that would have presided over the trial, and that would have been a good case. I totally understand though her position in deciding to drop the lawsuit. I mean, what you see a lot of times in cases where you have a sexual assault victim mm-hmm. is that the pursuit of justice oftentimes ends up re-traumatizing that victim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she went through a litigation process back before when she secured even a statement by the Department of Justice about the rights of incarcerated individuals. And she's kind of fought the fight. Now she mm-hmm. has decided she needs to move forward, take care of herself.
In a case where an individual was trying to prove that there was intentional neglect in terms of their safety in a correctional facility, and in this case, especially for a transgender person, what would have to been proven here? And now we know through the Department of Justice, through their investigation of just sexual assault as it relates in these correctional facilities for women. So what would have been able to try to prove here?
You never want a case to go forward just on a sort of a he said, she said type arrangement. You need to have some evidence. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, unfortunately, I think that you have jurors look at individuals who may be different, and sometimes judges. I mean, they try not to, but I mean, they look at individuals and they may assign different levels of credibility with them based on their status or station in life. And so you want to have some physical proof. That could be in the form of medical records. It could be in the form of photograph injuries. It could be in the form of contemporaneous notes or reports that were made at the time that the assault took place, sometimes with the medical staff, sometimes reporting to a prison guard. Mm-hmm. But then you also may look to policies that the Department of Corrections may have in place that are not particularly favorable to protecting individuals of Ms. Diamond's status. And you know, do they have provisions about showers and are people left alone with guards in mm-hmm. unmonitored areas? Are they, you know, these things that I think the first lawsuit sort of aimed to provide as far as some additional security.
And Attorney Moore, are correctional facilities required to investigate and at least document all allegations of sexual or physical assault in correctional facilities, whether it's from another offender that's in there with an individual or guards or staff or whomever?
They are required to take care of their inmates, mm-hmm. and that would include those types of investigations. And let me, if you think about it in this way, I mean, an inmate is a custodian of that or a custodial occupant of that custodian, meaning the facility. Mm-hmm. And so just like you have you can't have guards having sex with inmates because it's just presumed that they don't have the ability to consent. I mean, they're prisoners. They mm-hmm. they can't do it. And so there is a duty of the facility and of the department to protect those people who have been confined in the institution. And so unfortunately, I think again, while you have many good people working for the Department of Corrections, you have some people who are not. And who choose from time to time to victimize inmates or to take advantage of their position as corrections officers or administrators over people who are under their care and who really have very little voice oftentimes in making these kinds of reports. And they have to, I'm afraid, sometimes shout louder than other folks who are victimized.
And how challenging is it to get cooperation from staff, you know, correctional facility staff and guards of that nature because of just the environment?
It can be difficult. I mean, we were involved even during my time as United States Attorney with cases where correctional officers had abused some inmates. It wasn't the same type of case as Ms. Diamond's case, but mm-hmm. And it's difficult because there is oftentimes a code of silence that causes people not to talk, mm-hmm. and so, but just like many criminal organizations, and I'm not calling the Department of Criminal Organization, but just like that you see in some of those cases, mm-hmm. once you crack it, once you can get in there and get somebody talking, you then find other people who realize that suddenly they may be caught who are also willing to sort of spill the beans and tell the truth and tell the story. But it's an inordinate amount of work to get in there and sometimes to break down that chamber of silence.
Well, since Diamond's 2015 lawsuit did result in some reforms for transgender offenders in prisons nationwide, do you think perhaps then this might even going forward invoke more change?
I hope so. I think we have a lot to learn and a lot to do about making our prisons. I mean, we do need punishment in a society, but at the same time, we need places where they're safe and where we have rehabilitation and we offer employment training and job training programs, educational programs. And so I think sometimes that's our mindset about what a prison system should be. This is not the days of having people in the chain gang. You know, we hopefully become more enlightened in that. Again, you have many, many good people. And I know some, many good people who work in the prison system and who care about making sure that people get a fresh start after they've paid their penalty. We're talking, unfortunately, about, as we often do, those few people who sort of mire the reputation of other good public servants.
I want to shift for a moment and get your thoughts on some other legal news this week. Listen, after an 8-month probe, SCOTUS says, and that is the Supreme Court of the United States, folks, they have no clue who or how that Roe versus Wade draft was leaked. They don't know who did it. They don't know how it was done. There you have
surprise.
It.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. I mean, you know, the interesting thing about the report is that I don't believe that the investigators interviewed the justices. I think they interviewed law clerks and employees in the facility in the courthouse and staff.
And the person that delivers the donuts every morning, they interviewed them.
Right. You made people give over their cell phones and their call records and text logs, all this kind of stuff. But I don't know that they ever interviewed the justices. And that to me was the biggest place that it was likely to have leaked for some other reason. And so, unfortunately, I think that there's a lot of tarnish that's been put on the Supreme Court recently, and this just adds to it. And it's not what you want in the court. You want the people who are underneath the court to have confidence in the decisions handed down.
Well, and Attorney Moore, I think that's what for a lot of folks, you know, like us, the public, is like, okay, this is our nation's highest court. And so if we have these, quote, leaks, or we have a system where leaks can occur and we don't know how it happened, to something very crucial, obviously, when you talk about Roe v. Wade, going forward, how can the American public have confidence then in the system, in the process, which some don't even have confidence to begin with anyway?
Right. Well, and that's the fear. And, you know, I think that there was a time when you saw justices who protected the institution and the integrity of the body, as opposed to seeing it as just a political arm. But at the same time, you look at the confirmation process that goes on now and the circus that surrounds that process, as opposed to looking at a judge for his or her abilities and his or her academic prowess or life experience or whatever it may be. It's become a circus, and it's unfortunately taken on the mantle of another political arm of the government. And that's a concern, because the people who don't agree with the way that the court is staffed or the membership of the court, they're going to distrust. What you want to do is you want to be able to say, I can disagree with the court, but I can at least have confidence that justices of a fair mind reviewed the facts. I may not understand how the case came out. I may not agree with it, but I can at least have confidence that fair and impartial people did it. And that is something that, I hope the court can regain. I just don't see that now. And I mean, we could blame, I think, a lot on the prior administration about loss of belief in institutions. And there was just constant attacks during those years about on institutions of government, as well as what I see, political maneuverings.
Are the justices, are they protected from having to give up any of their own, like laptops, cell phones? I mean, we talked about all the other folks, but are there some protections in place for them that perhaps the others didn't have?
I think probably by fiat, you know, they've decided they're not going to do it. You know, think about this: when a justice can decide whether or not he or she wants to recuse themselves from a case, and that's the end of the decision, what he or she decides. So, you know, there's not a lot to it's a little bit like, you know, asking, is the king governed by his own rules? When you get to that situation. So I'm sure there was a decision that was made and circulated around the court and to the investigating group there at the court that there would be no interview of the justices themselves.
And
again, I'm speaking from having read excerpts and parts of the report.
You're not. And by the way, folks, it's via Zoom. He's not like winking at me, telling me this justice is the guilty person.
No, I'm telling you, from the public reporting thus far that we've been able to see, I don't see that the justices were interviewed as part of the process.
I want to talk about this again because we haven't talked about it enough. This Fulton County Special Grand Jury. Now we hear, you know what? Okay, we know that there is a report. Now, will it be released? Should it be released? Who gets to see it?
Right. Well, next week.
It's like whack-a-mole here.
Yeah. Next week's going to be an interesting week with Judge McBurney and what he decides to do. I've got really mixed feelings about it. I mean, on the one hand, I think that it would be good for the people to see that the time and treasure of the government and the district attorney's office and the court system has been put to good use so they could know exactly what this special grand jury found. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think that there's great value in keeping grand jury investigations secret. And that is because for people who may be named in an investigation and ultimately are not charged, and that happened, not to take the Trump case out of it, but in any situation, you don't want to ruin somebody's reputation if in fact they're not charged with a crime. And so when you release a full report, the grand jury may, in fact, say, well, this special grand jury may have said, well, we think that, you know, the DA should charge A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. And the district attorney says, well, I'm only going to charge B. Mm-hmm. Well, suddenly A and C have their name out in the public as people who a group of citizens felt like should be charged with a crime. They may not, you know, but that's within the DA's discretion, and that's within her consideration of the law and the facts and the application of specific facts to specific laws. And so there's a reason to keep it secret. But this, I fear that a lot of the stuff that's gone on with the Trump administration, even these investigations, has sort of turned normalcy on its head. Mm-hmm. We're now making decisions about how to react to situations that are not normal. And we can't change our norms and we can't change our safeguards simply because we're dealing with a situation that is so abnormal to what we've seen in this country.
Well, and it was abnormal for a district attorney office to file charges against a former sitting president or sitting president of the United States. Right. If this indeed does lead to this report being published, being whatever, that does set a precedent moving forward. And my goodness,
no question about that. And it will be something that is completely off the norm. And it's a concern again. You know, do we want to have a country where presidents and former presidents are indicted by local elected officials? Some could say that's a good thing. You know, I may take a different view of that. You know, I worry about, for instance, having a president, and in this case, you got a Democratic president who may say something in a jurisdiction, and a Republican DA decides they're going to charge. It causes us to question that, and that's one of the benefits of having the Department of Justice, which is seen generally as more apolitical because you have career employees and not elected officials who campaign on certain things. You know, Bonnie Willis has her hands full either way. And she's a good lawyer and an experienced prosecutor. What's interesting is that we are just at the beginning of this case if she decides to indict, because at that point, then we're going to start seeing the motion practice. We're going to start seeing appellate decision. We're going to start seeing everything taken and challenged to the appellate courts and up through the Supreme Court. And so we really have had 2 years of work and a year of the special grand jury, but 2 years since the election. And we're really just at the beginning of this race. And so we'll see where we go.
And finally, of course, you know, this week's the state trooper and the protester shooting death that took place here in Atlanta. Now there's no body camera footage, according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Once again, this is starting the debate over having one, a non-law enforcement agency investigate all of these, quote, questionable police-involved shootings, and especially when there's death or serious injury. What do you see going forward with this? Because as I read earlier, this is a mess.
Yeah, and again, I think some of this goes to our unfortunate distrust of agencies and institutions or governmental agencies. I think it's good to have trained people who are experienced in things like ballistics training and otherwise and scene reconstruction and this type of thing to be involved in cases. At the same time, you want the public to have confidence in whatever decision is reached. Mm-hmm. And so does that mean that somehow we also have a citizen review panel that works in conjunction? Does it mean that we put something in place I don't want us to get to a point where we look at an investigative agency like the GBI and say, well, they can't review this because they may say something, you know, they may be impartial. We ought to be able to look at it. And sometimes having a good prosecutor, I always think that it's important for a DA or a prosecutor to come out, U.S. attorney, sometimes to say, this is what I saw. Mm-hmm. I looked at it, too. I made a decision, and here we are.
But, folks, we even with the press conference that the GBI had, you know, the other day right after, not even having all the information, you know, one could argue they are already leaning toward law enforcement being in the right. And again, therein lies the issue with maybe an outside agency ought to be the one to investigate this. So we'll
I think that's something to look at. Again, I don't want to get in a situation where we say that outside agencies can't be impartial in review, but there's got to be a way to have sort of a blended review or even just sometimes it's honestly just the transparency. Mm-hmm. People, you know, I've found that the jurors and courts and the public can be very forgiving and very understanding if they just are told the truth and you level with them and say, this is what I saw. There's not all this secrecy and cloud and stuff, but we're not going to release that. Not going to talk about this. Sometimes, you just need to lay it out there and let people understand. And it cuts both ways. Honestly.
Attorney Michael J. Moore, former U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia. As always, we appreciate you bringing some legal insight into this. Thank you so much.
Always great to be with you, Rose. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Take care. You too. And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. $65 million. That is the largest gift to the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation. That's a lot of money. It is the largest in the foundation's 60-year history, and half of it will also be used to establish the Brown Hutner's Scholarship Foundation. If you've seen or if you've heard the movie Devotion, you might recall it's a story of the Navy's most celebrated wingman, Jesse Brown, the first black aviator in naval history, and Tom Hutner, his fellow fighter pilot and friend. Join us now with details about this historic scholarship fund. Is the distinguished astronaut, I'm just giddy, former NASA administrator and retired Marine Major General Charles F. Bowden Jr. Welcome. It's a pleasure. I need that jacket.
It's good to be with you, Rose. And please call me Charlie. Are you in Atlanta?
I am in Atlanta.
My wife and daughter are both honored graduates of Spelman. My daughter is actually from Spelman in Georgia Tech. And,
all right.
Did all her stuff there before she came to Washington, D.C. to be a plastic surgeon.
All right. We love our Spelman folks and Clark and Morehouse because I'll get an email.
Well, my mom's a graduate of Clark Atlanta U back when it was Atlanta U. She got her master's in library science from there.
That is what's up. Listen, when you first heard about this $65 million gift, and we should note it's coming from the FedEx founder, Fred Smith, when you heard about this, what went through your mind?
I was blown away. I knew of things that Mr. Smith had done before, and they usually had something to do with military members, but that's a lot. As you said, it's a lot of money. It mm-hmm. will help us. In fact, it's already helped us in the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation because we're able to serve more than 100 additional scholarships than we were able mm-hmm. to do before the $65 million gift. And as you already pointed out, Fred's stipulation was that we would share it mm-hmm. equally among the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation, which serves all kids of Marines and Navy personnel who serve with Marines. That's corpsmen and religious personnel. Mm. But that the second half would go to the Brown Hutner Scholarship Foundation, and that's focused on sons and daughters of Navy personnel who are interested in science, technology, engineering, math, or the health sciences.
I'm glad you brought that up.
A little bit different.
Yeah, because I think so folks didn't think that you have to join one of the branches of the military.
You don't have to join anything. All you have to do is be the son, the child of a military member, Navy or Marine Corps.
Let me ask you this, because you know you had over 100 combat missions during the Vietnam War.
Which means I'm old.
Now, see, I didn't say that. But, you know, when you think about, obviously, the so many careers within the military and where folks, I think you have to somehow be in some type of combat battle or whatever, but this really will help so many youth who can go in so many different directions within this branch of the military.
Exactly. And Rose, another point that is really important we don't pay attention to race, you know, or religion or creed. And you being there in Atlanta and being a person of color, you're very aware of the fact that our kids frequently get left out of these kinds of scholarships. If you look at the pictures of the kids that are receiving these scholarships, it's like America. And that's what I love about it. That's not an intent. It is actually the big intent is to serve the, as we promised all of our military members, we have their back and we'll serve them. And we're serving them by educating their children. But it does give our kids an opportunity to get an education where they might not otherwise do so.
Well, in this space where everyone's concerned about DEI and access and creating a pipeline of candidates that are diverse in whatever said field, when we talk about recruiting and training the next pipeline of aviators and astronauts dear to you, that's important.
It's critically important. You know, today we don't have, none of us are satisfied with the representation among the aviators in any of the services. But since I'm a Marine, I'm particularly disturbed by the fact that I'm looking for kids who can follow me and kids who happen to look like me. And we aren't doing a very good job of that. And so the Brown Hudner Scholarship Foundation will hopefully help us to bring some of those kids along because they've got to be interested in STEM courses. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation, they can major in anything they want. We just want them to go to school, study hard and do well and come out and make a difference in the world. So a slight difference between the two scholarships.
But when you talk to young folks, and I know they have a lot of questions, you know, what are those questions? I imagine one might be, you know, I can do this. Do I have to be excellent at math, or, you know, maybe my skills in this area, are a little lacking? I mean, what questions do you hear?
Sometimes that's the question. What do I have to study or whatever? And the thing that I tell them is what's most important is that they follow their passion. Everybody's not intended to be a scientist nor an engineer. Growing up in Columbia, South Carolina, I wanted to be an electrical engineer. I had no desire to go in the military. My dad had served in the Army in World War II, and so I knew about it. But I just wanted to go to school, get an engineering degree, become an electrical engineer, get out and go make money. And then at the age of 12, I fell in love with the Naval Academy through a television program called Men of Annapolis and decided that's where I wanted to go to school. And that I would go there, spend my 5 years of obligated service in the Navy, get out and go back to grad school and get my master's degree in electrical engineering, and the rest would be history. I fell in love with the Marine Corps through my first company officer at the Naval Academy, who was like my dad, tough but eminently fair. And I decided I was going to the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Found out that he didn't like crawling around in the mud. My wife kept insisting that we go to Pensacola, Florida, where it was nice and sunny. And I said, but there are airplanes there and I don't want to fly. She said, oh, come on, it'll be okay. And I did exactly what she said and fell in love with aviation and spent 34 years in the Marine Corps flying airplanes. So,
wow.
You know, it's the big thing that I tell kids is follow your passion.
Mm-hmm.
We need, you know, you're a journalist. We need journalists. We need people who can tell stories, particularly when we talk about the space program. So kids who come through the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation or Brown Hudner, we're hoping that they're going to want to do some of the things that their parents did. We're hoping that some of them will want to go serve in the military, but then they'll use their voices and their experience to tell other kids, you know, this really wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
I traveled the world. I had a great time. I now feel like I'm contributing to society. And that's really what we want.
And I have a couple of emails. Listeners are like, Rose, stop yapping and ask him again. How do we sign up for this? They told me to stop yapping. Email.
I'm sorry, Rose.
No, they're talking about me. They're telling me to stop yapping. Okay. Because I use that word a lot. Okay, I'm going to stop yapping and ask you again. So let's talk about there are two different pathways here in terms of these scholarships, right?
That's absolutely right. And but both of them begin in the same place. And that's go to the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation website, and that's mcsf.org. And either go and ask about Brown Hudner or just ask about Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation scholarship. It'll tell all the kids who are eligible that, you know, these are the prerequisites. This is what you need to submit and then go for it.
Wow.
Again, Brown Hudner is open to any child of a Navy, a sailor.
Mm-hmm.
Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation is primarily focused on Marines. and sailors or Navy personnel who have served with Marines. And that's generally chaplains, assistants, or corpsmen.
Sure. And I just want to say this as a storyteller, and I'm a big advocate of this, that we need to do more telling the stories of our Black and Brown folks from a historical standpoint and our armed forces. You know, I had a chance to some years ago to speak with someone I know, you know, Charles Dryden, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, and just just amazing conversation. So, you know, we need to do a better job of telling y'all's, as we say down here, y'all's story. You know, what'd you fly in Vietnam? It was a copter?
I flew the A6 Intruder, which is a two-place all-weather attack aircraft, not supersonic. It never, you know, 500 miles an hour was about as fast as we could go, but it's the most, I tell people all the time, it's the most incredible airplane God ever allowed us to create. It's the best airplane I've ever flown, and our mission was flown generally at night and low level, prosecuting targets of enemy down on the ground.
Now, I got to ask you this. All that stuff we see in Top Gun, did that really happen? You know, could you do all that stuff that Tom Cruise is doing?
I couldn't do all that stuff that Tom Cruise is doing, but my son, who is also a naval aviator and a Marine, he's a fighter weapons and sensor operator, WISO. He's retired now, but he actually went to Top Gun, or the Marine Corps version of it, and so he could do all that stuff. His dad couldn't. His dad's just a plain old attack pilot.
Oh, come on now. And listen,
I was a pretty good attack pilot. But
you're still here, so I mean, you know.
I'm still here, exactly.
Listen,
exactly.
I have another question that says, I'd love for him to describe the first time he saw Earth from space.
I cried. I was literally, you know, we had trained for years to get ready for the first flight, and being a person of African descent, I had diligently studied the geography of Africa because I wanted to be able to look down and pick some of the countries where my ancestors likely came from. And about 15 minutes into the flight, you know, having left the coast of Florida from Cape Canaveral and Kennedy Space Center, I looked out the window and I saw this big island coming up, and that big island turned out to be the continent of Africa. And tears came into my eyes when I recognized that all my life, for some reason, I had thought I would see borders and boundaries because that's all we ever talk about is differences among people and borders and boundaries. There were none. It was just one beautiful continent. And I couldn't tell one country from the other. So I welled up realizing that, you know, I need to go back home and tell people we're all one planet on one ocean, and we're all interdependent on each other. And we've got to get over these artificial divisions that we stick in our way. And it's no time more so important than today. And through the Scholarship Foundation, we hope we can help kids to have those kinds of experiences and be able to do the same thing.
Well said, and a good way to end this conversation. Wow, distinguished astronaut, former NASA administrator, and retired Marine Major General Charles F. Bolden Jr., thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed this conversation. We'll have a link to all the scholarship information from our website to that one.
Thank you so much, Rose, and give my best to everybody down there in Hot Atlanta.
I will. All right, now.
All right.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by LaShawn Hudson, Daniel Razel, and Pat St. Clair. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. A reminder, let me know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org, as you all love to do. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1. WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.